So we have a backup recording. All right. I have an uninterruptible power supply, but actually, that's just the marketing department wanted to call it that. It should be called the, you know, more or less for all practical purposes except for live radio purposes. Power supply. Uninterruptible for that. Yeah. Nice mumbling. Anyway, but the laptop, even if the power goes out, it's a laptop, so it'll just keep on recording. The backup recorder. If I was a poet, I would write an ode to it. Anyway, it has saved me quite a few times, I have to admit. All right, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. No guests, as far as I know. Just because I invite a lot of people doesn't mean that any of them actually are going to show up. It's looking more and more likely. I guess that they won't. But that's all right, because I'm just going to interview myself for a couple hours, and I'm real good at that. Sorta. You know, it's funny. I got quite a few compliments on my Bill Clinton rant the other day. Well, it was sort of a Bill and Hillary Clinton rant. And it was hardly all-encompassing because I sort of just came up with it off the top of my head. I jotted down a couple of notes. I really should sit down and come up with my master list of everything I hate about each of the two of them. Well, I guess, first of all, thank you for the people who complimented me on my Bill Clinton hatred rant. And secondly, I'll have you know that had I been prepared, I think it might have been, you know, really worth repeating somewhere. And maybe I could do a whole speech about Bill Clinton and why everyone should hate him as much as I hate him. Actually, I guess that's what the show is every day. Why everyone should hate everything as much as I do. So it would be a bit redundant. But anyway, I forgot. I had a point to make about that. I guess just thanks. A lot of people emailed me and were like, yeah, Matt, in fact, somebody even sent me some money. Hey, thanks for the Bill Clinton rant. That's some good radio right there. Oh, I know one of the things I was going to say about it was that I noticed all the mistakes. Like I said, yeah, he was impeached by the House, but then he was acquitted by the House. What? No, the Senate. And of course, I knew the Senate. I meant the Senate. And a couple of minutes later, I said acquitted by the Senate, referred to their failure to remove him from power, something like that. But I just said House, even though I meant Senate. And I didn't even hear myself say it wrong at all. I just went on. I only noticed on the replay. And there were a few of those. It made me wonder how many things I get terribly wrong on this show, not because I'm wrong about it, but just because my thinking box and my talking machine aren't connected together very well anymore these days. Sort of hanging by a thread there. Remember that time? Well, this would have been back in 08. I call for the execution of Glenn Greenwald, right? Like, I'm the proto-James Woolsey. I called for the execution of Glenn Greenwald, and it wasn't because of his treason. No, it was because I meant to say Paul Wolfowitz, you know, because of the war crimes. See, the War Crimes Act, there's a death penalty, capital offense punishment in there. And I was saying, well, this war criminal, you know, and I don't even really believe that. He should just do life in a cage without parole, Paul Wolfowitz. But I meant to say Paul Wolfowitz. And in fact, I guess, I don't know this anymore, but I assume I was probably reading a Glenn Greenwald article about Paul Wolfowitz or that mentioned something about him in there, and that was what got me off on the point about how guilty he was of war crimes. But I didn't even notice that I had condemned Glenn Greenwald as guilty under capital offense of being a war criminal in the Iraq War when, of course, I didn't mean Glenn at all, our good friend Glenn. I was referring to Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who lied us into war as a war criminal. So that happens. So if you ever hear me get anything wrong on this show, I want you to know that I'm actually right. I just didn't mean to say the wrong thing that I said. There you go. What is this? People sure do send me viruses in the email a lot. Alright. So, I was trying to interview 10th Amendment Center guys about all their successes, but they're too busy being successful. But they're getting legislation introduced all over the country. One of them was, I guess I ought to pull up the website. Well, on subject matter, one of them was a new anti-NDAA provision in a state legislature. I think that might have been Iowa. And then a couple of new anti-NSA bills have been introduced. I don't think any of them have been passed yet, but they've been introduced in a few state legislatures now. It got coverage, I saw, on the nullification and interposition movement on the NSA. Has gotten coverage. I think it was NBC News last week covered it. And it's gaining steam. It's just like with political candidacies now, with the with Facebook and with Twitter and email and all of that. Regular people can do the organizing and the fundraising on a level that it used to be only, well, basically people with access to power, people connected to the party and one or the other party, if you can call them that, in some way. You know, real independent forces outside of the typical organization of civil society acting around state power and mostly federal power is rising up. And it's going, I mean, the 10th Amendment Center, geez, I don't know. I wish that I had imagined the idea of a 10th Amendment Center. How beautiful is that? And what Michael Bolton and them are doing is they're just saying, hey, listen, when the U.S. government is breaking the law and when the federal courts won't stop them, and when the Congress keeps egging them on, then, hey, somebody has the power, the right, the authority to hold them to account. The people of this country. It's our country, not theirs. And if we have to get our state legislatures to pass laws and, you know, support policies that nullify and obstruct the federal government's unconstitutional activities, then let's do it. And what's great about it is all over the country people are saying, hey, yeah, let's do that. That sounds great. And you know, there's a little bit of scaremongering from the liberal universities and salon.com about how, oh, this is going to bring back the Jim Crow South or some kind of nonsense. But no regular person believes that. No honest person believes that. Just, you know, terrified sociology professors and stuff. So, all over the country and on so-called right-wing and so-called left-wing issues too, not just the National Security Agency, but on issues of gun rights, of course. But also, let's see. Oh, of course, all the pot laws, medical and otherwise, across the country. And somebody in the chat room helped me out with some 10th Amendment Center subject matter. What else are they nullifying these days? Anyway, the NDAA, that's where the president and the Congress pretends the authority to allow the president, even though the Constitution says they could only ever do this, it implies they could only ever do this in the event of an armed uprising, which is not going on in this country right now, or during an invasion by a foreign power, and under the complete and total laws of war for the entire country, that's Article 1, Section 9, that Congress can suspend due process of law for American citizens if they're accused of terrorism by whoever in the executive branch originally kidnaps them, I guess, under the pretended ultimate authority of the president anyway, and that Americans could then be held by the military without due process of law. That's the National Defense Authorization Act Appropriations Bill of 2012, and they fought back on that. And they're, you know, in California, they actually got a law passed and signed by the governor nullifying the NDAA. Now they're working hard on the NSA, too. That's offnow.org. and 10thamendmentcenter.com.org. I don't know. Well, whatever. 10th Amendment Center. Look them up. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe, and tell them Scott sent you. Hey y'all, Scott here. Anti-imperialism is at the center of libertarianism, as long as we keep it that way. So if you're part of a libertarian group, how about having me out to give a talk on the wars? I work cheap, and I'm good on everything. I've even been known to change a mind or two with some of these things. Check out some examples at scotthorton.org/speeches, and email scott@scotthorton.org for more information. By the way, this February 15th, the Future Freedom Foundation is having John Glazer and I give a talk at the International Students for Liberty Conference in Washington. Come on out and say hi. Actually, no, Mike Swanson is calling this off, man. It's the commodities window now in progress. He's out of the stock market. That was his recent market move that he advised. Sell all your stocks. This ain't going to last the rest of the year. All right, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And yeah, later on tonight, I got to cut some new spots. Wall Street window is changing. I mean, it may still be called that. But Mike Swanson's investment advice now includes get the hell out of all stocks before you lose your shirt. And it may go higher before it goes down, but it's going down, he says. And, well, I'd listen to him if I had any money in any stocks. If I had any money at all to invest in anything, I would certainly pay close attention. Well, no, I mean, I'm interested in that stuff anyway, you know. All right. So, this is the show. Now, Phil, a.k.a. Corky, in my emails asking about Ukraine. I don't know what his question is yet. Maybe that's coming up. But it's about Ukraine. Here he goes. Well, let's see if we got the whole question here. The whole question is the endgame a new East and West Germany here? Sounds like spiraling out of control. Your thoughts? Yeah, that's what I'm saying, too. In fact, I'm sad to say that the next email in line after yours, Phil, is Stephen Cohen saying he can't do the show. He's one of the guys I was trying to get on the show today. His piece, Distorting Russia in the Nation, is really good. And, in fact, I wasn't all the way finished with the dang thing. But I was certainly going to mention it to you on the show today anyway. And it's broader than just Ukraine. It's about America's relationship with Russia, but... Anyway, to rewind one email here, is the endgame a new East and West Germany here? I think, you know, I don't know. The problem is with things spiraling out of control, as you say. I mean, what does that mean, the spiral? It's like that vicious cycle. It's the more things go on, the more people don't feel like compromising anymore, even though now they need to compromise even more than they needed to compromise before. And so it spirals out of control. And that ain't foolproof. That's not, you know, that doesn't happen in all cases. And there have been different tries. I'm not up on the very latest to the minute of you know, negotiations going on there. I know that on TV yesterday, the foreign minister was saying, oh man, he wants so badly to meet with the opposition and come to some kind of agreement, but they won't meet with him and whatever. And I don't know if that's even a fact. I know CNN was letting him get away with saying it. But then again, it seemed pretty contrary to their narrative anyway, which is that the protesters are the people and the government is the government. Boy, you won't ever hear him make that distinction here in the USA. No, no, but anyway, they're saying there are different numbers, but I guess it's somewhere in the tens or low hundreds, low 100 numbers of people killed there. But that's bad. And now, you know, I'm conflicted about all this, you know, guts-wise. Factually, the facts are the facts, but guts-wise, my first inclination always is secession to the last man for everyone. And I'm always on the side of any civilian being beaten over the head by the state. But then I have another inclination, which is I always oppose the American empire because it is never, never, never justified in its interventions. And boy, cite Ukraine, for example, screwing around over there. So whichever side they're on, it's not that I become on the side of the other guys, but I certainly oppose America getting away with whatever their agenda is in somebody else's nation. And at the same time, I don't like Vladimir Putin either. And I'm sort of hesitant to say that, as much as I do hate him, because my government wants me to hate him, and it's useful for their narrative that we're all supposed to hate this guy and sign up and get your 2 minutes hate and whatever. But, well, the thing of it is, my wife, she's from Ukraine. And so she has, you know, just her family history includes reasons to not like the Russians, sort of, you know. And I'm sympathetic to that. You know, if you were Ukrainian, you might feel the same way. You might not, depending on who you are and where you're from, I suppose. But then also, she's got a real thing for hating Vladimir Putin. And not because she's an imperialist, an American one, and he's a Russian nationalist, but because he murdered her friend, Anna Politskaya lady. I can't say her name. Politskaya. Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't say her name. What, do I speak Russian? But anyway, this journalist, Anna Politsa, she was Eric Margulies' friend too, and my wife, that's Larissa Alexandrovna, and Eric Margulies, they both agree, and I don't know all the facts, but they both agree that Putin killed her because she was doing her journalism too good. And, you know, in my wife's case, this was actually a friend of hers. Well, and in Margulies' case, too. Although I'm not married to Margulies, it matters more that this is a friend of my wife's that Vladimir Putin murdered. And, oh, geez, I don't know if I'm allowed to tell that story or not. But anyway, the wife don't like Putin, and I'm sympathetic to that. And the guy's a right-wing nationalist, and I'm not sympathetic to that. I'm only sympathetic to that in the sense that it means that he's hell-bent on maintaining Russian independence from the American Empire. Good for him. As far as that goes, as Just Raimondo calls him, he's Putin the Patriot. Because look at who he replaced. Boris Yeltsin, who got drunk, passed out, bent over, and let America and America's friends loot the place for 10 years straight. And, you know, start a war in Chechnya. I don't know. Start a war. I don't know all the details of it, but certainly the Russians started a war there in Chechnya. And he's the one who passed the... Yeltsin's the one who passed the place off to Putin in the first place. Remember the sort of soft push of the millennium there? It was on New Year's Eve, 99, New Year's Eve 2000 kind of thing? Which do you call it? 99 or 2000? But yeah, right then. And Yeltsin went ahead and resigned and appointed his prime minister president with the election coming up in 6 weeks or whatever. Putin destined to win, and especially after having been the commander of the renewed Chechen war in the last year leading up to the election, all that. So he's a bit of a strong man. I don't know all the details of how the government, the Russian government functions and exactly how strong of a man he is compared to other power inside the country, but it's not a totalitarian communist dictatorship like it used to be. And but anyway, I'm off on a tangent. My point just being that I'm not siding with the Russians. If I'm siding with anyone in the conflict in Ukraine, I side with all individuals who are not government employees in Ukraine. That they all have the right to be free of government policies. That's what I believe in, no matter who you are, wherever you are in the world. I don't believe that any of those Ukrainians have the right to enslave other Ukrainians under their preferred policies. I'm not a fan of democracy because I think it basically just is a bogus rubber stamp on vast crime, which, not that dictatorship is better, but at least it's more obvious in that sense. But I do prefer democratic transfers of power in governments to dictatorships. I don't mean to confuse that issue, but I'm just saying democracy a lot of the time just means majority tyranny and not much more than that. But I don't want to see democracies overthrown just because the sore losers are the losers, and especially if I'm all suspicious as can be that the sore losers are backed by the Americans, and that this whole thing amounts to, sorry Ukrainians on the street with your opinions, amounts to a power play between the Americans and the Russians that doesn't really have much to do with Ukraine, except that they're the pawn in the middle being fought over. And, you know, from the point of view of the people of Ukraine, they're stuck in the middle. And now here's the real point that I gotta make is about America, because that's where I'm from. And that's whose government I'm ostensibly responsible for. I'm trying to take responsibility for its behavior, you know, as best I can. They say I have a duty to and everything, so they're the ones who are threatening to turn this into a civil war. Ukraine doesn't have to have a civil war. But, you know, Obama was on TV yesterday going, I expect this, I expect that. As though he is the emperor of all of mankind. And whoever it is in Ukraine that he expects whatever of, better do it. They're his personal property. And he expects this and expects that. And, of course, we heard his ambassador to the EU on the phone with his ambassador to Ukraine talking about the country as though it was just a county in, you know, one of them northeastern states, one of them little bitty ones. Well, we don't want this guy for county commissioner. Let's see what we can do to put him in there. And some, you know, what would be a low ranker. Who do we want for mayor in Newark? Or something like that. If you're a major power player in D.C., how do you treat, you know, city-level politicos? That kind of attitude when they're talking about the government of Ukraine. And as this guy Stephen F. Cohen writes about in The Nation, where the hell do we get this idea that Russia has no interests in the world? You know? And we can just do absolutely whatever we want. Any pushback whatsoever amounts to a threat, an attack on us. You know what the problem here really? It comes down to, it sounds sort of like that Commie Critique of that corporate takeover of the news business, man, where you just don't have someone even as smart as Sam Donaldson up there anymore. Everybody doing news is some stupid blonde-headed lady, which, you know, I like stupid blonde-headed ladies, but I'm just saying, they're brilliant blonde-headed ladies, but I'm talking about the stupid ones. They're just stupid blonde-headed ladies up there because they look good. News consumers like fantasizing about them, and so they talk about the news and whatever. But there's never any real understanding or context about any explanation or behind any question asked of anyone talking about any of these things. It all just is taken permanently for granted that Ukraine belongs to us. We'll do what we want. And if that means they have a war, then that'll just be a thing that happened. That won't be our fault, even if everyone knows we caused it. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
Hey, man, how's it going? Welcome back to the show.
I'm Scott Horton. And yeah, Ukraine. I don't know all about Ukraine, but I know that the U.S. government ought to butt out right now. Completely and totally. See? MCA agrees with me. Yeah. And anyway, I mean, just think about how ridiculous it is the way they put it across on TV, that this is just the people, the government clamping down on the people, brutally clamping down on the people. The people, why, they only want what's right. And the government will only just clamp down on them. And then they just completely neglect to mention that the people in power were elected and, in fact, cleaned the clock of their opponents in the last elections. Now, this is at least supposedly and ostensibly, maybe both or one or the other, and I don't understand vocabulary terms well enough, but seemingly to many, this is why the U.S. government kills in the world all day, every day. We have to give people democracy so that they will stop killing each other all the time, and they'll just take turns in power. And be nice. And, you know, it'll be great. And then you win some and you lose some. And then that way, when you lose an election, instead of trying to overthrow the government, you just try to do better next time. See if you can get more people to agree with you and join your political party. You know, all that stuff. That's why George Bush killed 1 million Iraqis to death. 1 million individual human beings. 1 million of them. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people torn to shreds with high explosives. Or dying of cholera. Or shot at a checkpoint. Or a Delta Force night raid. For democracy. So that them Arabs will finally learn that if you lose an election, that's okay. Just try harder next time and make better arguments and win people over to your political party. And then maybe you'll do better and then it'll be your turn. And the other guys will have to wait their turn for a little while. And your policies will differ by 2%. It'll be just like America. But in Ukraine... Oh, we don't need to hear about who got elected to what. All we need to know is the government is not doing what America's government wants it to do. So they are the bad guys. And the people in the street who are trying to nullify the results of the popular election that they lost, why, they're the heroic, downtrodden masses that must be protected. And just imagine if someone really tried to pull an Arab Spring, Tahrir Square-style Occupy movement in Washington, D.C. Tens of thousands of real dissenters occupying buildings and fighting with cops. Barack Obama would have them shot. They would be shot. They would, at the very, very least... many of them would be shot and the rest would be run out of town with tear gas and truncheons. And if you think otherwise for a minute, if you think the U.S. government will ever lay down and surrender power, that any politician in that White House or any group of criminals in that Capitol building would ever lay down their power and authority and turn it over to a peaceful uprising outside, well, then... You need to get back on your lithium, dude. Or you need to put down that crack pipe and start smoking weed again. Because, come on, we all know better than that. That's stupid. Barack Obama or George Bush before him or Jeb Bush after him would massacre you by the tens of thousands if they had to prevent anything like some kind of soft, popular popular-ish uprising, color revolution style putsch in America. They would nuke D.C. and run the country for Mount Weather from now on before they let a bunch of occupiers take over a damn thing. And we all know that. But whatever, that doesn't matter. Shoe on the other foot doesn't count, ever, when it comes to American foreign policy. Ever. You know, even shoe on the other foot in Ukraine, right? We're not even supposed to stop for a minute and say, well, what if America backed the democratically elected government of Ukraine that won in a popular election? In fact, clean the clock of the pro-Russian guys. And then it was the pro-Russian guys who were staging the massive sit-ins and occupying buildings and refusing to compromise and were just completely insisting on the resignation and abolition of the current government in a putsch like this. What would the American Empire spin on that be? An attack on democracy by the fascist, Nazi, right-wing, nationalist Vladimir Putin, right? Right? And that's not to side with the government there, because, again, I'm always on the side of the individual versus the state. But when it comes down to the fight between the Americans and the Russians, just look at how corrupt America's position is here. Because America is so hell-bent that they've got to get Ukraine to tilt away from Russia and toward the European Union as a step toward eventual membership in the NATO military alliance. So that if any Putin ever again gets the idea of exercising influence in Ukraine, it'll mean nuclear war? What the hell kind of bluff is that? It used to be the line of the bluff was Berlin, but not even really Berlin. But the line was West Germany. I think if the communists had absorbed West Berlin, depending on when they did it and how, they might have gotten away with that. Marching straight into West Germany, that probably would have led to a nuclear war back during the days of the Soviet Union. There was a line somewhere, and it wasn't the Atlantic Ocean. It was Western Europe. And I think probably any president of the Cold War would have gone ahead and gone to war over that. But now we're talking about going to war, going to nuclear war, going to civilization-ending nuclear war if the Russians ever threaten Poland or Lithuania, or Latvia, or Ukraine, or even Georgia. Can you imagine? Tell you what, you tell me where Georgia is first before you tell me how important it is that they have to join the NATO alliance so that any war between Georgia and Russia would turn into a war between Russia and all of Europe and the United States too. We're like that Pakistani general in 1998 I saw on TV. Now, you tell them Indians, we're not afraid of their atom bombs, right? That's our attitude toward the Russians. Now, we don't care if we get into a nuclear war with Russia. We can whoop them. I mean, yeah, we might lose hundreds of thousands of American lives, maybe millions in the process, but we win, though. You know? We're not afraid of you. You know, I still think to this day that India and Pakistan really blew it by testing their nukes the same week of the Jerry Seinfeld show season finale or series finale there, which was a real flop, right? It wasn't even good. But people were so excited about the Seinfeld show, they missed it. India and Pakistan were testing nukes. They need to get better PR guys. I'm sure they got good PR guys in D.C., but they need good PR guys in flyover country and in Los Angeles as well. But anyway, yeah. I do want to recommend this article, Distorting Russia, by Stephen F. Cohen in The Nation magazine. I'm 70% done with it here. It's a fan of the show, has sent me a couple of different articles by him. Prodding me to finally hurry up and get him on the show. And so finally this morning I read the dang article and okay, agreed. He'll be on the show as soon as I can get him on. In fact, I may try to interview him for the KPFK show. Oh no, you know what? They're still Fun Drive, right? I won't be on KPFK again until next week. So, I'm going to try and see if I can get him on for the show tomorrow. Russia expert at The Nation. And I like it good enough, what I read of it. And then, now, here's one that, you know, I don't know what the hell is the matter with me yesterday. I guess I was just hungry or something, but I didn't do a very good job of interviewing Cade Crockford. She's brilliant, but I didn't ask all the right questions I wanted to ask anyway, such as about this piece in the Washington Post, which I kind of made a joke about this on Twitter, which I already completely ruined by telling you it was a joke I already made, but I'm going to go ahead and tell it again, which was that I've been predicting this for so long that nobody remembers me predicting it anymore. I bet if you ask my mom, she would tell you, yes, it's true. Yes, it's true that ever since the 10th grade, Scott has been saying, which would have been, you know, 1994 or something, 93, 94, something like that. That yes, ever since the 10th grade, Scott has been saying that they're going to be... Well, she wouldn't call me by my last name like that. Scott has been saying that there are going to be cameras everywhere, all up and down all the highways and all the roads, taking pictures of your license plate and sorting them all in a database and keeping track of where everyone goes all the time. But now, 20 years early is too early to be right about something, isn't it? Or else, somebody come and pat me on the back, damn it. Because I've been good on this for a long time. Homeland Security is seeking a national license plate tracking system. In fact, Cade Crockford now has an article about this at privacysos.com this minute. And what she's saying is, guess what? See, I really should have asked her about this. She knows all about it already. And that is that there's a private company that has already got the contract from all of, I guess they help install Vigilant Systems. That's what it is, Vigilant Solutions. They help install all these license plate reader cameras in the first place, and they've been keeping track of all the license plates in their database anyway, all the location data in their database anyway. This was misreported in a few places. She sets the record straight. The story here is that the DHS will be buying access to this database. Holy Vigilance National Vehicle Location Service holds more than 1.8 billion records already. And you know what? I guarantee you NSA is already tapping into this thing and already has full access to it anyway. They have access to everybody's database about everything. But, man, so it's really coming to it. It took longer than I thought it would take, honestly, man. If I knew I had had 20 years breathing room back then, I might have taken it easy a little bit. I guess they've been working on it. But there you go. Yeah, man, you're not free. It's funny. You remember the 80s? In the 80s, well, early 90s even, before you ever imagined it would be like this, remember? Before you ever imagined it would be like this, total tracking of your location everywhere? You never imagined, right? Hey, y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy, only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org. Oh, man, angry Sunnis with rifles. We've been real lucky so far about my predictions on Libya. They ain't come true yet. I told you back in 2011, man, don't forget about this ridiculous Pottery Barn rule that, of course, was made up by Thomas Friedman. God, I wish someone would hurl him into space. Man, you break it, you own it. If you bomb a country and destroy it, well, now you have to put it back together again in a very loving fashion. Even if it takes you 8 years and the sectarian cleansing of the capital city and a bunch of lies. And what happened? They bombed the hell out of Libya. They got a regime change against Gaddafi there. They turned the place over to the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, veterans of the Iraq War, who just finished fighting the Americans there. Ansar al-Sharia and associated Islamist gangs and whatevers. And they left. I guess they figure they've got the oil lands in the Far East. And so if the country goes to hell, fine. And who's they? Does the National Army control the oil lands? Do the Houston oil companies have a secure environment to operate there? I don't even know what's the latest news about the American or Western oil companies out of Libya. But I know that the rest of the country is just completely devolving back into tribes. And I'm not one who thinks that the Westphalia nation state is the epitome of the achievement of mankind or anything. It could very well be that more of a militia, stateless sort of a society there, tribal leadership and that kind of thing, traditional ways, is maybe a better way to maintain peace and stability in the former Libya over the long term. In fact, I suspect that's true, especially if somehow you could just, you know, twinkle your nose and freeze the rest of the world, or at least the American Empire, or, you know, for that matter, the rest of the Western powers, from further intervention. But as long as further intervention by the Empire looms, then that's not a very good way to keep the Empire out. And as long as there are Sunnis with rifles that you can take pictures of them and they're angry and shooting each other or something like that, then you can call that a crisis. Now, I have to say, man, I'm pretty proud of America's Vietnam syndrome right now. The American people have just, you know, you look at all the polls, they're absolutely sick of war. You know, the Afghan war, which started out under the excuse as legitimate revenge for hunting down and targeting the people who were responsible for the attacks of September 11th, is now the least popular war in all of American history, including, you know, the Civil War, including Iraq, which never had any legit excuse for it in the first place. And I'm not saying invading Afghanistan was based on a legitimate excuse, just one that a lot more people buy into, or bought into then anyway. The truth is, the Taliban offered to give bin Laden up. They didn't want to be invaded and regime changed, but the Empire wanted to invade and regime change them. So they said, yeah, surrender, not good enough. And went ahead and launched the war anyway. But there's a war that was begun under the pretenses of what Americans tend to still believe in. Boy, they sure do believe in it at all the airports for some reason. Why are airports so militaristic all the time? I mean, I understand that soldiers fly, but so do the rest of us. I don't get it. It's ridiculous. Anyway, God dang it. I got off on militarism at the airports thing. And, forgot the hell I was saying. Oh, yeah, the American people. They're sick of it. Except at the airports. They're absolutely sick of the militarism. They now oppose the war in Afghanistan, one that they tend to believe was begun for legitimate purposes. They oppose that more than any other war in American history. More than Vietnam. You have more people still supporting the Vietnam War in 1971 than you got supporting America in Afghanistan right now. And so we saw this same sentiment keep us out of Syria, and the same sentiment is propelling us toward a nuclear deal with Iran right now if nobody screws it up, Benjamin Netanyahu. And it could be. I don't want to underestimate the American people. In fact, if I should be dishonest on this show ever, it should be to fake how much I believe in you. Come on, Americans, we can do it. All you got to do is be as good as this stuff, as good on this stuff as I am, and be better at activism than I am. Call your congressman, organize, create a group called, you know, Springfieldians for Peace Now. And go and make sure that your congressman is, one, reliably anti-war. Reliably. Not just says so, but will behave that way. And two, you know that you'll do everything you can to make his life miserable and or replace him if he's not. But three, assuming he's good, that he's as well educated as he could possibly be so he can win the argument on Capitol Hill every time. Right? Get it done. You know, this is why the Israel lobby has ruled D.C. for so long. It's because they do the work. They get it done. They make phones ring. Their telephone tree, you know, like people's moms used to do for charity on the March of Dimes or whatever. You have 10 people that you call, and they're all supposed to call 10 people, and they're all supposed to call 10 people or whatever. Well, AIPAC actually gets that done. They get it done. All their email lists and all their echo chamber projects, they do the work. And so with American sentiment, popular sentiment the way it is now, with, you know, a reasonable amount of effort, I guess it's possible maybe to stay out of Libya forever after now. And I guess the only reason they got in there then was because nobody cared, because they promised it would just be an air war. And they promised they wouldn't care about it anymore after that. And they lie their asses off about how Gaddafi was going to butcher every man, woman, and child in Benghazi that he had sworn to and all this. Whatever. That he had the capability to. Yeah, right. But anyway, here's my point. You let the pigs over at National Review read antiwar.com today and we might have a problem. Because Ramsey Baroud has this piece about the Libyan bedlam. General Hifter, the CIA, and the unfinished coup. And this is about how the CIA's, you know, choice. We mocked this guy before. It was in McClatchy newspapers. He's a big fat expat, been living in Virginia for 30 years, 25 years or something. Led a failed coup against Gaddafi back forever ago. I thought Hifter was the one that got killed back in 11. It was Hifter that killed the other guy, but then he got, you know, marginalized. Anyway, this guy, General Hifter, he's the CIA sock puppet. He tried to do some kind of coup, but all he did was announce it, but he didn't do anything, and nobody listened to him. And it was the coup that didn't bark. It was a coup that, I guess, growled once and then just sat back down on its haunches and it was over. And never had a prayer of consolidating monopoly power in Libya. The only reason, apparently, that Gaddafi could was because Gaddafi was a ruthless dictator. And, you know, his secret police would kill you and would enforce their monopoly for real. Their monopoly on violent force. Nobody in Libya these days has that authority. And if you read Ramsey Baroud, the part that, you know, is going to get the National Review guys upset is one, another CIA failure here. Although, I don't think they'll want to talk about the broader problems in Libya beyond the Benghazi, you know, incident that one day back September 11, 2012. The one day that something happened in Libya that you need to know about. All right, otherwise, forget it. Because they're responsible for the entire context. But what I'm worried about is that, you know, John Kerry or Bill Kristol or any of these guys, in or out of power, who push the American empire, could seize on this bedlam, as Ramsey Baroud describes it, as an excuse to further intervene. And in fact, you know, I don't even know. I admit to you, I plead guilty of ignorance. Criminal ignorance of how many American special forces operatives and or other Army, Navy, Marines, or Air Force personnel are stationed in Libya right now. You know, what kind of bases do they have? Teeny tiny or pretty major or a piece of an airport or what? I can't say that I really know. How extensive is the CIA presence in Libya right now? I don't really know. We have not seen yet a large army presence there to train up an entire new army like we saw in the occupation of Iraq and in Afghanistan. The joke in Afghanistan of training up an army there. But it could happen. And, you know, boy, I'd rather be wrong than be right that the U.S. empire is going to be wedded to whatever outcome in Libya from now on. Because, of course, you know, whatever outcome they ever get, it'll never be what they promised. It'll always be an excuse to intervene more. And, of course, once you have American army on the ground there, then you might really have war break out. Right now, it's not really a civil war. There's violence, but it seems like, you know, it's mostly these sort of, you know, local powers sorting out their turf rather than conquering it from each other, you know? And their parliament, I guess, still meets. But I don't know if anybody does what they say. Doesn't seem like it. You know, Vice Magazine had a reporter done some good stuff on Libya. Maybe I should get him on, too. Hey, y'all. Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. And, yeah, I gave this speech one time back in 2010. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on scotthorton.org/speeches, I guess. Right? War and the Boom-Bust Cycle. And, well, what it is, here's how I'll set this up for you, man. I told you about this story yesterday. Oh, great. Now I can't find it again. Oh, it's on antiwar.com today. Isn't it? Yeah. Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State by David Stockman. This thing is great. Man, you gotta read it. And here's what it is. It's a speech by him. When I first started reading it, I thought, hey, this guy's plagiarizing me. And I thought, oh, no, wait a minute. He knows the same stuff as me, only a hell of a lot better than me. And I want to read his book. I got it, The Great Deformation. I will read it someday, I hope. But man, this is the greatest history of the last 100 years of central banking and war and how things work in this society, what maybe you already knew some of. What maybe you don't know at all, what you all definitely need to know. And it's so good. And the thing of it is I couldn't really take you through the article better than just the speech I gave myself already. The only thing is, you know, this is, you can assume, virtually perfect compared to my piece of crap speech. But, you know, my speech would be the best summary of it. It's really long and really in-depth. But, so, if you want to hear this at all, don't take it for a substitute for David Stockman's piece, but take it as kind of an ad for, you know, this is the very, very light version of Stockman's speech is the Scott Horton one. So I think here it goes. Let's see. And it's going to definitely be better than anything else I was going to say today with my babbling incoherence. already feel guilty for subjecting you to an hour of this so far. So if I can get it queued up, I only just decided to. See, I thought, yeah, here we go.
So this is the Rally for Peace and Prosperity, but I'm kind of an anti sort of guy, so my talk is going to be about violence and bankruptcy. This is a situation that we're in now. Now, lots of Austrian economists, beginning with Ludwig von Mises and on through, have shown that the business cycle, as they call it, is caused by the central bank's intervention in the economy, their creation of new money, the artificial lowering of interest rates with police power to make it seem like there are more savings in the economy, so that people invest in projects that turns out are unsustainable projects. There wasn't enough capital to get them all started, so we have the boom, we have the bust. And I think that's really the best name for the business cycle is the boom and bust cycle, because it's really all about war. That boom is the shock and awe tearing human lives apart in other people's countries. And then the bust is the economic pain that we suffer. Obviously, one could just think about it and draw some conclusions from just the last 10 years in this country and what we're going through with our economy right now. But I'd like to go back through a couple of examples from history, the World Wars, Vietnam, the First Gulf War, to illustrate my point. The Central Banking Act, the Federal Reserve Act, was passed at the end of 1913. The Federal Reserve was established in 1914. Most people tend to think of the Federal Reserve as some kind of New Deal reform from the 1930s, but in fact, it had predated the New Deal by 20 years and was in fact the cause of the Great Depression that the New Deal supposedly was the solution for in the 1930s. The Central Bank, as I said, took form in 1914. And the next year, Colonel Edward Mandel House, who was Woodrow Wilson's closest advisor, Wilson's Cheney, he's been called, the next year he went to England and secretly negotiated American entry into World War I 2 years before it actually took place. And in order to pay for America's involvement in World War I, which began in 1917, of course, they went to the Federal Reserve to create the money out of thin air. If they'd raised the taxes on the American people in order to pay for a war to go save the French and the British, the American people would have balked. Instead, they made it look like it was cheap. And the consequences came later, the consequences being the panic of 1920 and 21 after the end of the First World War. And now at the time, the president was Harding. And he had a Treasury Secretary named Andrew Mellon who prescribed that they do nothing to solve the problem of this panic. And nothing they did, and the panic was over in just a couple of years, which is why almost no one has ever even heard of the Great Depression of 1920 through 21. It was over by 22, and growth had started again. And of course, in the 20s, there are all kinds of new technologies and new expansions of the American economy in all different ways. But what we call the Roaring 20s didn't really get going until 1927. And they had a pretty easy money policy throughout the 1920s, but in 1927, Benjamin Strong, who was the chairman of the American Federal Reserve Board, did a favor for his mentor, Montague Norman, the chairman of the Bank of England. And because they were having their own troubles, he decided to devalue the American currency in order to prop up the British pound. To do so, he created a ton of money out of nothing, lowered the interest rates, and created the giant stock market bubble that we all know of that popped in October of 1929. Now, without getting all the way into the New Deal reforms and Herbert Hoover's role, I urge everybody to read Murray Rothbard, America's Great Depression, and you can see that all Roosevelt did was continue the policies that Hoover had already started, even though they try to pretend that President Herbert Hoover was some kind of Ron Paul laissez-faire free market guy. He was actually a Northeastern progressive and initiated the New Deal. But the way we all learn it in school is that the New Deal did a lot to help us, but then it was really World War II that saved us from the Great Depression. Now, if the New Deal was such a great thing, you might wonder why in 1941 the Great Depression was still going on. But, you know, I don't know. For some reason, that seems to fly. Anyway, so once World War II got started, or American intervention in World War II got started at the end of 1941, they conscripted 16 million people and exported them to other people's countries to go and fight for freedom. That did wonders for the unemployment rate. And now look at all the new opportunities for women. Don't you want to go put rivets into tanks and airplanes to help kill people in foreign countries? It's very empowering. And so anyway, what they teach us, though, is that the New Deal worked well, but it was World War II that really saved us from the Great Depression as it ramped up all that industry and so forth. But as Robert Higgs has shown in his book, Depression, War, and Cold War, the government simply fiddled with the numbers. They took all their deficit spending on war materials and then counted that as the GDP and said, oh, look at how great all this war spending has been for the economy. In fact, the Great Depression lasted all the way through World War II until it was over, and the guys came home and were able to, and because of all the rations and restrictions on the economy and the country during World War II, they finally went ahead and got to rock bottom in that Great Depression that they'd been trying to prevent with all that stimulus. When the guys came home from World War II, they were able to take all those new factories that had been built to make the war machines and so forth, and turn their swords into plowshares. And so the economy is finally able to get going again. Also, of course, at the end of World War II, the entire world had burned to the ground. America was the only industrial power left standing. And so anybody who needed anything on Earth needed to import it from America. And so, you know, that was a very unique situation that is different and certainly not applicable to the common theme that, well, war is good for the economy, which is what they try to teach us. Now, the specifics of the 1950s and the Korean War I'm not as good on, and also most people don't know much about it anyway, but I know that you guys can relate to the history of Vietnam, that you know if it's not you, it's at least your parents, your uncles and aunts who lived through that time, who can explain that era. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson was not just the world's worst warmonger responsible for the deaths of millions of people, but he also was a socialist who pushed all of his great society programs. Now, in order to pay for that war and all that socialist spending, they had to turn on the money machines. And they created a giant bubble which popped in 1968. For 10 years after 1968, the Johnson and the Nixon and Ford administrations inflated and inflated. They spent deficit spending to stimulate the economy, to try to prop up the economy to the bubble levels from the 1960s instead of letting the correction take hold. And what happened, of course, what we call stagflation, which all the prominent economists at the time said was impossible, that you would have a high inflation rate and a high unemployment rate. Well, that's what we had. A bunch of people out of work with prices going through the roof every day on their store shelves. And eventually this led to Nixon putting on wage and price controls, like some nightmare out of the old world, which, of course, led to shortages and was a terrible catastrophe. Well, finally, at the end of the 1970s, Paul Volcker was brought in to become the chairman of the Fed. And he decided that they were going to abandon the program of stimulating, abandon the program of deficit spending. They were going to jack the interest rates through the roof and force the correction, put the economy in a stranglehold, and liquidate all the bad debts and some good ones too. Get the American, the price system back to its natural level, maybe even a little bit below. And perhaps some of y'all remember that at the beginning of Reagan's first term, everybody hated his guts. Somehow he was reelected with 49 out of 50 states in 1984. Why? Because the recession was over. They finally began lowering the interest rates again and let the economy get back going on its feet. Still, the people were suffering in 1982-83 from the war in Vietnam from 15 years before. Another one that's a pretty common example that you guys can remember from your own experience was the first Gulf War in 1991. Bill Clinton ran and beat George Bush handily with the slogan, "It's the economy, stupid." Well, what was wrong with the economy? Well, they just created a bunch of money out of thin air to pay for a war against Iraq. And then the bubble had crashed. They needed time to let the prices settle back down before they could get a good start again. And because it was bad times, Bill Clinton could easily just say, "Are you better off than 4 years ago? Of course you're not. Re-elect me instead." And so he won. Still, the connection wasn't being made in public anywhere between we just spent all this money killing Iraqis and now we're all broke. Because, of course, we all learn in school that war is good for the economy, like World War II. And so how could it be that the one thing causes the other? Now, the greatest example, of course, is our contemporary experience with the war on terrorism. When George W. Bush took office, he very rightfully said, hey, this recession was already here. This is the Clinton recession. I just got here. This isn't my fault. I want everybody to remember. He was absolutely right about that. That Bill Clinton had had his own giant bubble, the dot-com bubble in the stock market, etc., because the American people wanted their peace dividend after the Cold War, and the only way they could deny it to us and continue to expand the empire around the world was to make it all seem like it was free. Who needs a peace dividend when we're all making money anyway? Let them build bases in Kyrgyzstan or wherever they want. So that was Bill Clinton's bubble, and it had popped. When George W. Bush came into power, he was in the middle of a recession. Then September 11th hit. And not only did September 11th hit, it hit downtown Manhattan. So here the United States was due, for a severe recession. The airlines were hit. The financial systems were impacted severely. And instead of letting that recession take hold, these Republicans wanted to have a war. They couldn't have the American people out of work complaining about how they can't put food on their family, as George Bush likes to say, while they're waging one war in Afghanistan and trying to start another one in Iraq. They had to make it seem free. And in fact, not only did they make it seem free, they said the oil will pay for it. Whatever oil we take out of the ground in Iraq will pay for all the invasion and the reconstruction and everything. That's what Paul Wolfowitz and Donald Rumsfeld said. And to prove it to you, they sent you checks in the mail for $300. Not only are we not raising your taxes, we're giving you stimulus money. You're going to get, everyone who pays income taxes is going to get $300. Look at how much money we're making off of this war. And for the entire first decade of, or almost the entire first decade of this century, reasonable people were wondering, if the government is spending so much money killing people all over the world, expanding Medicare Part D and all these other big government programs that George Bush did, he didn't do anything to repeal anything from the Clinton era. How come everybody's so prosperous with all this spending, all this wartime? Well, it was because the Federal Reserve had turned the money machine on full blast. They had lowered interest rates through the floor, and they were pouring money into the economy. So people were saying, well, geez, maybe I should be broke, but then again, I just refinanced my house and got a check for $20,000. I think I'm going to do it again in a year. And so the illusion was there that not only is war good for the economy, apparently it's really good for the economy until the crash comes. And that's the whole thing about economics, is you can have police power and you can have a money machine and you can manipulate things with your bubble gum and strings and your smoke and your wires, but ultimately it's no different than the laws of physics. And the laws of economics will come due. And that's what we're suffering through now, is the crash of September 2008. And of course, all that they can conceive of to do there in Washington, D.C. is continue to lower interest rates, keep them at near zero, continue to print money full blast in order to bail out all the rich, to try to keep unemployment below at least 10%, the way they count it, 10%. It's really more like a fifth of the American people out of work right now. But it could be worse. We could have a worse recession that's over quicker. But they don't want that, because if the recession is really bad, we might just say, you know what? Let's stop killing Afghans. We're spending too much money killing Afghans. We're spending too much money killing people in Yemen and in Somalia and in Pakistan and in Iraq, where 50,000 combat troops are still stationed. And so maybe we need to just abolish the empire and take care of ourselves. They don't want us coming to conclusions like that. So they want to keep stimulating and keep stimulating. And as local jurisdictions across this country are making decisions like how many months of school, how many extra months of summer should the kids have at school? How many teachers are we laying off? How many roads can we afford to continue paving? And this is really happening. These are debates that are happening at municipal utility districts and county court levels all over this society right now. We can't afford to pave the roads. We can't afford to keep the schools open. And at the same time that this is going on, the warlords of Washington continue to expand the empire around the world. They are not happy hiring the Ethiopians to go and murder Somalis. They want the American Army and the American Marine Corps in Somalia murdering them firsthand and on your dime. And if it comes down to it, the people who rule this country will cannibalize every last bit of wealth and property we have in order to keep their Pentagon. And the real danger is, at this point, because of all the propaganda that we suffer from the time we're little kids, the vast majority of the American people really agree with us about the U.S. state. They don't trust Washington, D.C. at all. But what do they trust? The Pentagon. Who do they trust? General Petraeus. Now, there's a man who knows how to get things done, I heard on TV. And there's a man who, if you ask Sarah Palin, there's a guy who knows how to command things. We don't need a lawyer up at a lectern. We need a commander issuing commands from wherever they issue commands from. And as we risk, now you hear Ron Paul, and there other speakers will probably be addressing this later in the day. You hear Ron Paul and the other prominent Austrian economists talking about their fear that the last bubble is the bond market, that the investments that people have made in American securities, that bubble could finally break, that all those dollars could come flying back here, and you know we could be spending $100 bills like dimes. That's the kind of danger that they're playing with all this inflation, costing the dollar its reserve status over the world. And you could see real chaos in this society if the dollar breaks the way that people like Ron Paul are predicting it will. And so then I think the real question is, what do we do? What do we believe anymore? When the real crisis comes, are we going to turn to General Petraeus to bring the army out, to bring us bottles of water and food and keep us safe? Or are we going to recognize that we made our wrong decision back generations ago when we decided on this world empire? That it's not the American way that's failed, it's our abandonment of the American way that's failed. It's acting like the empires of the old world that's destroying us. And can we recognize that all we have to do is embrace the principles that we all assent to, whether libertarians, left, right, or anybody else, the principles of the Declaration of Independence, the principles of the American Bill of Rights. If we can believe in those principles, maintain our belief in those principles, then we can come out of this okay. The danger is that we will turn once again to the government to solve the problem that it has created for us. So, in closing, stop believing in them, because all they ever say to you is lies anyway. And usually the lies that they're telling are with purpose. They need you to believe the lies so that they can get away with doing horrible things to you. And so it seems like maybe we could just stop believing them. If the last 500,000 things any politician ever said within your earshot wasn't true, maybe that's a clue that the next couple of million things out of their mouths will also be a deception. So that's really all I have to say. Stop believing in the legitimacy of the U.S. state. It's responsible for destroying our society.
That's funny. I totally forgot what my ending was supposed to be. I had an ending, but I just couldn't remember what it was going to be. So then I just made up that at the end. that's pretty funny. All right. So now that was the ridiculous junior high school version of David Stockman's great piece. You can find it at antiwar.com today. It's called Keynesian Myths, Monetary Central Planning, and the Triumph of the Warfare State. And here's the thing about this Stockman guy. So he used to be some kind of Reaganite, but wait. So he wasn't a Milton Friedman monetarist, which they're sort of like the monetary cousins of the neoconservatives. People like Jude Winiski. And I'm trying to think of all the more famous Reaganite monetarists. Jude Winiski. And I guess Paul Craig Roberts, too. I think he was a Friedmanite monetarist. No? Anyway, I don't know. But Stockman, so he wasn't a Chicago school. He was, I guess, more of just a classical economist, a classical school, a free market economist. But he's become more and more Austrian because, of course, the Austrian school, particularly Mises and Rothbard, they have the real answers to the business cycle in, which nobody else has. I even asked Bob Higgs over the weekend, has anybody come close to explaining the business cycle in a way that makes any sense other than the Austrians? No. Right. Anyway, it's just the context that nobody else seems to understand. You know, everybody's lost in this college version of economics that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense about aggregate this and that, as though it doesn't matter what money's being spent on. And, well, you can see what they've done with us, with their booms and their busts and their wars. But so this guy Stockman, he gets, as time goes on, he gets better and better and better as, at least economically speaking, as a libertarian, extremely anti-warfare state and extremely anti-welfare for rich people, and very, very hard on Milton Friedman in here. He explains, and this is the part that I skipped, which was in my mental notes, but somehow I spaced out in that speech. I'm sure you noticed. I didn't mention Nixon taking us off the gold standard. I just threw him in there with Ford and Carter for just keeping inflating as much as they could. But Stockman really makes the point about how Friedman came, Judas, and he's the one who handed Nixon the right-wing so-called free market libertarian cover to take America off the gold standard and say what we need is to monetize debt and to inflate. What we need is central banking. And Milton Friedman, for all the good he's done in teaching people about free market economics, man, his wrong conclusions on the Great Depression and how the Federal Reserve should have done more to inflate after it, never mind what happened before it and all of that, became the excuse for Nixon to really screw us good. Other than the mass murder of a couple of million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians, this is the worst thing that he ever did, was break the last link to the foreign gold standard, at least the Bretton Woods gold standard there. And it was Friedman that gave him the cover to do it. And read Rothbard. Read Stockman. Read this great thing, man. I like anybody who is a former Reaganite economist who now is like, man, this is how Friedman ruined everything because he was such a commie on the money issue. Then, yeah, man, I love that stuff. You're exactly right. That's why the Austrians are right and the Chicago school is wrong right there. And war. The Austrians, all of them, anti-war. Show me a warmonger Austrian. Peter Schiff, when he's running for office. But the rest of them, all peaceniks. Let's see, I made a couple other errors in there, too. Oh, I skipped the Reagan bubble that popped in 87, 88. That stock market bubble, because after Volcker, they got rid of him as fast as they could. They inflated another bubble that popped in 87, 88, and that was the nuclear missile buildup and all the brinksmanship against the Soviets. The cost of arming the Ayatollah. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. $100. Don't you think that's a little steep for an Edward Snowden action figure? I mean, it's a full-size G.I. Joe, kind of pretty badass, although the hands and the face, the skin tone don't match there, it doesn't look like, but I think that'd be awesome. They have a Julian Assange one, too. I think that's cool, man. Good old Ed Snowden, huh? All right. Yeah, so the bond bubble breaking. Now, here's the thing. You might remember, say, if you're a longtime listener to the show, you might remember me talking to good old Robert Higgs. He's an economic historian, hardcore libertarian anarchist, and scholar at the Independent Institute, author of Depression War and Cold War, Crisis and Leviathan, Against Leviathan, The Resurgence of the Warfare State. He's the editor of the Independent Review. Serious libertarian scholar. Think maybe the best, most favorite one of mine. Back when, he used to say things like, don't listen to the doomsayers, okay? Because you know what? There are a lot of problems, but there are a lot of, I'm paraphrasing him from last weekend now, cross currents going on, and you never know what's going to happen. And a lot of these predictions sure seem to be coming from people who are in the business of making bad predictions more than really giving an honest analysis, an informed analysis about what's going on. And so, yeah, you know, even if America, even if the empire has hit its high water mark, it ain't over yet, not by a long shot. And even if we have a massive financial crisis of 2008, that doesn't mean that they're not just going to keep going down the same road still. It's the same thing they did back after the last dot-com bubble. And for all the predictions of all the over printing and creation of money. There's a lot of cross currents there, right? A gazillion dollars worth of bad debts and bad bets that had to be liquidated in the crash of 2008, the Iraq war bubble. And what happened is that they created a lot of new money. There's so much bad debt and actual, you know, cancellation of credit out there that it amounted to a massive deflation. Can't help it. So what they did was they put the pedal to the metal. They inflated like crazy against a lot of downward pressure on prices. And so they held them. And they've driven them up a bit. And of course, we all know they lie. They rig the inflation rate terribly. If you go to the grocery store, you know there's price inflation. You don't care what it says on TV. Hey, guess what? There's hardly any price inflation at all in the last couple of years, says TV guy. Really? I guess you don't eat food then. Because for the rest of us, yuh-huh. And for a lot of things. But still, the point being, it could be a lot worse. Anyway, there are a lot of people back in 08 when they were first starting this QE madness where they were saying, oh, we're going to have absolute, complete and total hyperinflation within a year and a half or something like that. And Bob Higgs, he's too calm and too smart and too sober for stuff like that. And his attitude was, yeah, well, let's wait and see. You know, things are bad, sure. But are we going to really have some kind of massive hyperinflation? You know, I don't know. But then, when I was hanging out with him over the weekend, I mean, I'm not claiming he said the words hyperinflation. I didn't really push him on this point particularly. But one of the things that he was talking about was the fact that the Fed has been paying the banks to keep all the money that it created and gave them at the Fed. But he pointed out, contrary to conventional wisdom among the people who know this fact and talk about it and talk about how dangerous it might be if the banks all start loaning it out, he said he's only paying them what I guess the official rate is 2%, but then with the official inflation rate, whatever it is, I forgot the math exactly what he said, but it was that they are losing out. They are not being paid to keep it at the Fed. They are losing money over time to keep the money at the Fed. In other words, the banks are now in a position where, and you can see how it's sort of a self-perpetuating thing, where they got to go ahead and loan this money out. The more they loan out, the more inflation there is, the more they got to go ahead and loan it out. And then once they start loaning it out, then everybody who receives the loan, they turn right around and deposit it. And then the government and then the bank turns around with a permission slip from the government and they loan out that money too. And then the guy gets that loan, he turns right around and deposits it. And all of a sudden you have a possibility. And see, I even pointed out, well, but hey, guys, and it was Higgs. I was interrupting a conversation between Higgs and a guy, Sandy something, who was a very nice guy. I didn't properly introduce myself to. Unfortunately, I feel bad about that now. But he seemed like a very smart Austrian economist type guy, too. And I was saying, but yeah, in this climate, what small businessman would a bank want to make a loan to? If he's going to lose money there, too. And they said, yeah, but, you know, eventually, as things finally start settling, there are going to be good investments to be made. This money is going to start getting out there. And then the implication is, and this is where Mike Swanson, sponsor of this show from Wall Street Window, and author of The War State, he says, yeah, his fear is the bond bubble, that eventually people are just going to stop believing in U.S. government bonds. And, you know, Charles Goyette said on this show, and you can tell I'm not the master at all of this stuff, but Charles Goyette said on this show, which this is a fact, or he wouldn't have said it, the only net buyer of U.S. debt right now is the Federal Reserve. China and Korea and Japan, they're still buying debt, but they're selling more of it than they're buying. It's the crack-up boom in slow motion. People are diversifying out of U.S. debt as fast as they can. And people say that, you know, China, you know, that whole thing about if you owe me $1,000, you're in trouble. If you owe me $1,000,000, I'm in trouble kind of thing. Where they wouldn't dare dump their U.S. debt because it would hurt them so bad to do so. Yeah, but then again, there's such a thing as time preference, and taking your lumps now or taking them over the long term worse, you know? It's a judgment call, and especially if you're asking a Politburo to decide, they don't really care about prices that much, do they? Sort of, but not really. So, it could come a time where you really do see all those dollars floating back. Governments and major corporations and banks all over the world have treated U.S. dollars, stacks of U.S. $100 bills, as though they're gold bricks in their vaults, as the reserve for their own currencies. And so I don't know the total number of trillions in circulation in the world here and abroad and what, but it's a lot. And then, of course, it's you and me stuck here somewhere between San Diego and Bangor, Maine. We're the ones holding the bag. We're the ones that got "you have to spend this money only" written on our dollars. You know that legal tender rap? So, might could hurt. Now, I don't mean to mischaracterize Bob Higgs' statements, because the truth of the matter is I really dropped the ball right there. I really should have followed up and said, "Are you saying? What are you saying, sir?" And I guess the topic got a little bit turned around, but, well, I mean, I guess the consensus around the table was that Mike Swanson was right, that this is the danger. I believe maybe I'm taking it too far to say that the breaking of the bond bubble would necessarily mean hyperinflation, but I think that's right. I think that's the implication anyway. Dollars become worthless when nobody believes in them anymore. People recognize the real count of just how many of these things Ben Bernanke's created. Hey, you know what, too? What was I just read? It's in that David Stockman piece that Ben Bernanke, when he wrote his PhD, about how Milton Friedman was right, that the Federal Reserve should have created more money out of nothing in 1929, that the guy who awarded Bernanke his PhD was Stanley Fischer, the new vice chair of the Fed. They put this lady Janet Yellen in there. She may really be the chair of the Open Market Committee, but she doesn't seem to have that forceful of a personality to me. And it was the guy that gave Bernanke his PhD in how wrong Milton Friedman was, and Bernanke thought he was right, that the problem of the Great Depression wasn't that the Federal Reserve had created money out of nothing, artificially low interest rates, artificial expansion of bank credit across the land under Benjamin Strong throughout the 1920s, and especially 27 through 29. No, the problem was that once the markets all fell apart for no reason whatsoever, not that they had been completely ridiculously artificially high for no reason that anybody ever heard of or anything, but once that collapse happened all of a sudden, like an asteroid out of the blue, well, that's when the Federal Reserve should have begun an expansionist monetary policy. Ah. So, looks like more of the same. That great economist Jeremy Sapienza once said to me, he said, "Hey, the Fed, they're just going to print money. They don't know how to do anything else. They're just going to keep expanding the money supply." And I think that's about right. I think the days of a Paul Volcker, this is something I learned years ago too. What Volcker did in jacking up the interest rates and forcing the recession that they'd been trying to prevent all those years, that they went off the gold standard to prevent all those years, the last vestiges of it, that was the last time that that could happen, because when he did that and raised interest rates up to 20 whatever the hell percent to completely strangle the economy and force the recession and lick inflation, the national debt was only a few hundred billion dollars. It was like 600 billion. By the end of Ronald Reagan, it was at $4 trillion. And by now it's at 16, 17 trillion, right? So the quarterly payments for the interest for the bondholders of the national debt at just even any kind of, imagine what a free market interest rate might be, 6%, 10, bankrupt America like that would make paying the interest on the debt the single biggest piece of the federal budget. How you like that? Getting raped all year long by the IRS just so they can pay the interest to a bondholder. That's it. Your entire contribution goes to the Bank of China or to some jerk, your neighbor. instead of yourself. For holding the interest on the debt. Oh, I heard that the government was here to take care of my grandma for me. Nope. They're here for killing people and stealing money. And wasting it. And wasting way more than they can steal. And therefore destroying your entire society in the process of attempting to take it all. That's the way they're going. I don't know, man. I'll tell you what. You read what Charles Goyette wrote in The Dollar Meltdown and then tell me. It seems to me like a real worry. I have to admit, it hadn't gotten as bad in time. Like I think he thought. But I think Bob Higgs was saying it still could. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
This stupid show still on?
Not this guy still. God, when's the next show coming on? Oh, it's me. Oh, I hate this guy. Yeah. All right, hey, I thought this is cool, man. Matt Taibbi from Rolling Stone has left Rolling Stone. He's going to work with Glenn Greenwald and Jeremy Scahill and them at First Look Media. Well, if nothing else did, that tears it right there. This First Look thing is going to be a big deal. Because this guy, Taibbi, he's a real force of investigative journalism, man. His stuff, well, he's done a hell of a lot of work on a lot of subjects, but especially he's most known for his work on the financial crisis and all the corruption in American corporatism. Really good stuff. He's not a libertarian, but that's all right by me. If you're not very familiar with his work, you should be. You know, I believe he's the son of Mike Taibbi from NBC News. It's been a while since I watched a lot of TV news, y'all, but I think that's right. But anyway, I mean, never even mind that. He's been, for a long, long time, a really great reporter. And the fact that he's now joined up with Scahill and Laura Poitras and Glenn Greenwald over there at First Look Media. Now, I don't think they said he's going to be at The Intercept. And you know what I think? If you had to ask me, and this may have already been answered, I don't know. But my guess is that they're going to give him his own thing. And it's not going to be The Intercept. He's going to have his own Taibbi vehicle there, which will have his own staff and his own alliance of journalists, which he'll bring. And he'll have a Greenwaldian fiefdom of his own there at First Look Media. I sure hope that's true. And I bet you dollars to dimes that Glenn Greenwald would want it that way. Would want this guy to like, hey, yeah, just join up. Make us look good by association, and then do what you want, man, right? I bet you that's the deal. I'm only using my imagination, but I'm thinking that there's going to be some great stuff coming out of this. That's my theory. All right. And now, here's the thing. Do you like Anthony Gregory? Do you like Tom Woods? Me too. You know what's great for listening to? Tom Woods interviewing Anthony Gregory. And guess what all about? The left and the right. It's great. Anthony Gregory, he's brilliant. And Tom Woods, well, you know Tom Woods, man. That guy's a genius. And the thing of it is, they're both very libertarian. Well, look, Anthony Gregory is the walking definition of libertarianism. Tom Woods is pretty damn libertarian. Gregory, you could trade him for Sheldon Richman for most libertarian person on earth, I think. So what they're talking about is the left and the right. And what can be done by a libertarian to reach out to people who identify with the left and the right for whatever reason and get them to, you know, give up that stupid crap and be more like us. You know, against everything. And for liberty. And Anthony's just a brilliant genius. He's a good friend of mine. They're both friends of mine. They're both good friends of mine. But anyway, it's a great conversation. You can find it at tomwoodsradio.com. I'm sure it probably played right before the show today or yesterday. I don't know. But I heard the replay of it. Tom Woods comes on before me on this channel. But it's just great. It's just fun to listen to these two guys who I interview all the time and about this kind of stuff talk to each other about it. And I came up in there because of what I told Tom Woods about how I actually had something nice to say about Obama, which was the way he's pursued this nuclear deal with Iran. Not the way he's done it, but that he's done it at all, really. But Anthony went on to basically ignore that, which is good, and say, yeah, but other than that, he's basically worse than Bush. And I forget if he exactly made the caveat about the body count in Iraq and how the invasion of Iraq was just absolutely horrible in a way that kind of outmatches anything Obama did. But I think he was focused more on the precedent set where he just wages these, you know, undeclared, just lawless presidential covert wars and drone wars all over the world and assassinates American citizens and, you know, has at least perpetuated the torture regime under Appendix M and all that. You know, Anthony Gregory's just great, man. He's great on principle, but he also really has his facts together all the time. And, you know, yeah, he's a friend of mine, so it's confirmation bias or whatever, but, you know, I'm listening to his facts, and I'm basically trying to check his work, and it's good, man. He knows. I'm telling you. So, good times there. And why would anyone be a liberal or a conservative? What bankrupt ideologies? And they're just excuses for wanting to control other people, you know? But other people don't belong to you. So, knock all that off. How about an ideology of live and let live for real? A consistent one. Peace and freedom. Alright. Yeah, it's libertarianism. Ask Anthony Gregory. He'll explain it to you. So, listen to that. And then here's another thing. I always got another thing. I ain't out of things by a long shot. But maybe for today I'm running low on time for them all. I saw a thing this morning about, you know, in Georgia we're working on a law that will be amnesty for a drug possessor, user, who calls an ambulance for a fellow addict who is having an overdose. Because what happens is a junkie ODs and his friends split because they don't want to go to prison and then not be able to do heroin or at least, you know, as much or something. And so they're saying, listen, what if we gave amnesty to the other junkies that like, look, man, it's cool. If you call 911, call the ambulance and they come out, we'll let you go. You'll have amnesty for that night. It won't amount to a search warrant later or whatever. You'll have amnesty so that it's okay to take away that disincentive. Because the thing of it is, of course, that junkies are people. It's a bad word to call someone because it dehumanizes them, but it is what it is, you know? There are people who are terrible, hopeless heroin addicts. That's what you call them, junkies, right? And they'll steal from you even if they're your best friend, a lot of them, so I'm not saying that either. I'm not saying it's a good habit to be a junkie. But they're people. I don't know if it's still a crime. I've talked about this before. It used to be a crime anyway to go around finding junkies and giving them clean needles. Because that amounts to saying it's okay to be a heroin user. When they're giving each other AIDS and then giving it to other people too. Even if you say a junkie condemned himself as though you should deserve to die of AIDS just for getting high with needles, you know. But then they're spread it around. AIDS, man. AIDS. Oh, no, but it's a crime to give them a clean needle to use. Make them share. Heh. Well, here in Georgia, they're getting their act together and they're saying, well, let's maybe give them amnesty. If your friend's ODing and dying, go ahead and call an ambulance. We won't arrest you. But doesn't that really just... It's not... It does beg the question, right? That's the proper use of the phrase, begs the question. It doesn't just raise the question. It begs the whole damn thing. Why in the world would anyone ever get arrested just for being a heroin addict? For possessing contraband. This is a free society. This isn't the Plymouth Plantation where Jesus ordained the local minister with totalitarian powers over us all. And this ain't communist Berkeley, California either. Although I think they're probably, for some reason, would probably be better on the heroin issue there. For some reason you have a right to use heroin but not control your life in any other way. Depends. These liberals and conservatives with their weird ideologies. And public health, yeah. And public morality, yeah. Like, I'm not much of a collectivist, but sure. There's a thing about whether you have a town full of junkies or a town full of people who are good, hard-working folk who aren't a bunch of junkies. But there are ways to deal with that other than endless SWAT team raids. There are ways to deal with that other than spreading AIDS. There are ways to deal with that other than making people be afraid that they will be kidnapped and locked in a cage like an animal if they call an ambulance for their dying friend. How did it ever get set up that way in the first place? Doesn't that sound like something must have gone wrong? That there's this massive incentive to let your friend die? That we need to create a loophole there, because we created a massive incentive to let your friend die. What kind of madness is that? That's upholding a moral society? That's sending the right message to kids that it's better to be afraid that the cops will, it's better to run than go to jail if your friend's dying of an overdose. It's better to see a bunch of addicts give each other AIDS and die, or buy black market heroin and die of overdoses. And especially, it's good to argue about this at a time when legalization of pot, rhetorically speaking anyway, well, and factually speaking, is at an all-time high. People are, you know, getting more used to hearing these arguments, having their mind a little bit more open, less of a crybaby, tiny little emotional reaction. Oh, wait, he said legalize heroin, turn it off. Well, I don't know, listen to him for a second, maybe. And also, you have Philip Seymour Hoffman, who they're saying, and I'm not the best judge of this, I like the guy. They're saying he was the greatest character actor of his generation. One of them. Right? He wasn't some ridiculous, you know, star. He was a serious actor, right? He did characters you could actually believe in, not just a cameo in every movie he was in or something, right? He was a serious actor. People really appreciated his art. And now he's dead because he's buying black market heroin and dosing at the wrong levels. Unaware of the proper dosage, what he needed to for his tolerance level. And it happens every day to people who aren't movie stars, but whose lives also have value, too. So, yeah, by all means, pass your amnesty and legalize heroin.